All right, good morning, everybody. This is Anatomy, April 15th. And I personally would like to thank each and every one of you for paying your taxes. It's excellent, right, to keep this economy going. Okay. So let's see, we were in the census chapter, but we didn't quite get through. We were talking about hearing. Maybe I got to turn these lights down a little bit. And we're scheduled to have a test next time, including the heart. So let's see how much material we can get through. It might be that we have to postpone the test until a week from today instead of on Monday. Not really too sure. So don't leave class early, right? Because I'd hate for you to go home over the weekend and then cram all weekend and realize that there's no test on Monday. All right, so just stay tuned. But SI is going on as usual. I believe SI met today. Did you guys meet today? Yeah, and then you got a meeting on Friday, and I think there's a practice test or some kind of warm-up test on Friday as well. So that's probably worthwhile to go do that kind of stuff. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over what we were talking about so far? You all know the difference between general senses and special senses? And which ones are we talking about in this chapter? The special senses, right? Because special senses, you only have the ability to appreciate the modality in one or two areas of your body, and it usually requires some complicated kind of organ in order for you to appreciate that modality. And there are five special senses. What are those five special senses? Okay, well, I tell you what. You know what? I'm surprised I'm here at class this morning because I'm still sound asleep. So I tell you what, let me ask that question again and I'll pay real close attention to what you're saying. What are the five special senses again? Olfaction. Yeah, that's one. Who? Oh, yeah, gustation. Very good. Okay. That's ringing a bell now. That's taste. Vision. Hearing. And then, two that we have to cover today have to do with equilibrium or balance. There's two balance kinds. There's one called static, and there's one called kinetic. Static sometimes is called linear. For linear balance, it measures linear acceleration, and kinetic has to do with turning or twisting motions. So sometimes we call that angular acceleration. Okay, so we have special organs in our ears to appreciate those different senses. All right, so I did see a question. Those are smells. Like camphor might be something you might smell like in mothballs. Okay, so that's kind of a recognizable. And what was the other one?
Etheric.
Oh, etheric, like ether. Yeah, ethery kind of smell. That's maybe like a little perfumey but not sweet kind of smell. All right, something like that. Maybe in lab, you could ask your lab instructor to let you smell some ether. We used to anesthetize people with ether, and so you can't smell very much of it, but we do have a little bit of it around. Yeah, etheric. Ether is just a very volatile compound that has a very distinctive kind of smell to it. Okay, I don't know if I can describe it any better than that. Yeah. Which one would? Food? It would be some combination of all those kinds of things. Just like taste would be a combination of all the primary taste sensations. Okay, well, as a matter of fact, let me just ask, what are the primary taste sensations? Sweet, bitter, sour, salty, umami, right? And I just last night, not that I was eating anything that reminded me of this stuff, but I thought of something that you would actually eat that is a combination of all those things. Is anybody reading my mind? What is kind of sweet and salty and sour? Okay. Like a margarita, for instance. Can you taste a margarita right now? What it kind of tastes like? Tastes salty, tastes sweet, right? Maybe a little bitter, sour. Got a little lemon flavor to it. I don't know about that umami in there, though. But maybe we should try that. Oh, when it's first cut, broccoli has some umami in there? Okay. All right, so I got to tell my nephews that's when they should eat it, right when I cut it. They'll feel like eating it then. It's good for, broccoli is really good for you for a lot of reasons. Yeah, another question. Yeah, that's ammonia. And ammonia is, it's a very acrid kind of scent. It's like an acid, it kind of burns your nose a little bit. It's not really acidic, it's so basic that it burns your nose. So it's a very noxious stimulus, and so it has a tendency to wake people up. That's ammonia. Yeah, if you don't move your nose away from it, it certainly can. And you might lose your sense of smell for a couple weeks until those... depending on how bad you burn your nose. Yeah, depends on how badly you burn the nose. It probably should. And of course, the younger you are, then the better the chances are that things will grow back. But people do lose the sense of smell because of that. Okay, maybe smoking or some other kinds of things.
And what is it that gives people a stronger
sense of smell? That's a really good thing. We used to think we knew a lot about taste, and we would say that on the tongue there are certain receptors for sweet, and those are primarily on the tip of the tongue, and the receptors for bitter are way in the back of the tongue. And then people realize that, guess what, not everybody's the same. And so I'm beginning to think maybe it has a lot to do with your culture, how you grow up and what kind of foods you appreciate, what kind of tastes you appreciate, and then you just learn how to appreciate different things. And I think culture plays a certain role in that as well. Yeah, so I think, but then again, some people do smell things differently. There are certain chemicals that people can't taste, and that chemical other people can taste, and it's really obnoxious. I forget the name of that chemical, but we do that in a physiology lab. It's like a little strip of pH paper that we put, that somebody can put in their mouth, and some people can taste it, and it's really bitter, and other people, it's like putting a regular piece of paper in their mouth. So we do have different, all of us do have different senses. More than likely, yeah, but there's probably some cultural influence to that as well. Yeah. I think probably most guys can see colors as well as women, but for me, since I'm colorblind, does it matter very much? I mean, it really doesn't matter if a guy's colorblind or not in our culture, right? It's probably more important for women because they're more involved with matching colors and things like that. It's an awfully sexist thing to say, but it's maybe true. Okay. All right, what about hearing? Should we get on with hearing? We got to get on to hearing. All right, so I think we were talking about the ear last time, or maybe we didn't get to the ear, I'm not sure. We're about ready to enter the inner ear. So don't forget, there's three main parts to the ear. There's the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. And you got to know the lines of demarcation between those three different structures. All right, and so here is the outer ear. One more time, the auricle right here, or the pinna. And all these cartilages in the ear have names to them too. I don't think in lab we make you know some of these different names of the cartilages right here. But did you have to know the tragus and antitragus? The tragus is up over here and the antitragus is down over here. And the antitragus is actually used a lot because healthcare providers like to pull on it sometimes. Why do they like to pull on it? To get a better view? Yeah, they might want to look through this external auditory meatus and take a look at this tympanic membrane right here. But actually, there are a lot of times doctors say they'll do something and they'll ask you, oh, does that hurt? Right? Well, what they're trying to find out is if there is an inflammation in the middle ear right here that sometimes is maybe a little bit hard to see, but sometimes they can look in with an otoscope and actually see an inflammation of that tympanic membrane, and you put traction on the antitragus, and if that causes discomfort, then that's a pretty good sign that that's a middle ear infection. All right, so then the middle ear is between the tympanic membrane and the oval window. In lab, you could probably look at the stapes right here and see that the footprint looks very oval. It's not round, so hence that's the oval window. And then the round window is down over here someplace. Okay, so what's the job of these auditory ossicles? Well, sound is a mechanical wave, and when that mechanical wave bumps up against the tympanic membrane, it vibrates back and forth, right? Just like your rear view mirrors in your car when you got the stereo turned up, right? And then those vibrations get transmitted through these auditory ossicles into the oval window, and there is fluid in this little bony structure right here, and then that mechanical energy enters the fluid, and you can hear those vibrations as a result of that. So the auditory ossicles transmit vibrations from the external ear to the inner ear. That is their job. And notice that there's a little bit of amplification because the tympanic membrane is really big and the oval window is relatively small, so that introduces a lot of energy, sound energy, into the inner ear. Okay. So what about the three parts of the inner ear? We see something that looks like a snail. That's what we call the cochlea. And what we're looking at right now is something called the bony labyrinth. All right, so there are a lot of compartments inside these little bony structures, but so we're just looking at the outside parts of all these structures, which we call the bony labyrinth, and there are three parts. The bony labyrinth for hearing is the cochlea, this thing that looks like a snail. And the other two senses that we have in the inner ear correspond to the next piece right here. This is the vestibule. And the vestibule gives us a sense of linear acceleration. And then the remaining parts, the remaining bony labyrinths, are the semicircular canals. And this is the bony labyrinth responsible that gives us a sense of spinning or twisting. All right, so I think we're going to look at the inside parts of these structures now. Oh, let's see. This probably looked like a decent kind of slide. And inside the bony labyrinth, we have fluid. We have fluid inside the cochlea, fluid inside the vestibule, and fluid inside the semicircular canals right here. So now let's look inside the cochlea. Okay, the cochlea is way back over here someplace. Okay. So the cochlea, you see, is just the spiral. It's all wrapped up. And why do you think the cochlea is all wound up on itself? It's all kind of wound up like that. Why is that? It's actually a fairly long structure, and if it wasn't all wound up like that, guess where it would be sticking? It would be sticking outside your head. Okay, so that's just the way that evolution has figured out how to put this organ inside your head without having it sticking out. All right, so what we can do in order to describe what's happening here is, in an illustration, unwind it to take a look and see what's happening inside the cochlea. Okay, so here is a cochlea that has been unwound, but in normal everyday anatomy, it would be what? It would be coiled up inside your ear. So here is the middle ear. Here's the stapes that is vibrating up against the oval window. That introduces sound energy into this first top compartment right here. This is what we call the scala vestibuli. And the scala vestibuli has got perilymph in it. It's a fluid. So sound enters this perilymph. And it could go all the way to the tip of the cochlea. Sometimes we call that the helicotrema. All right, and then it can then enter this chamber down here, and then that pressure is released by the round window. The round window is going to vibrate back and forth. And that's really important because if energy enters the oval window and it has no place to escape the ear, you know what might happen? It might just break something in there. It might rip some tissue apart or break the cochlea. So that energy has to be released. So that's how energy can be released. And this structure right here, okay, this is what we call the cochlear duct. There's fluid in the cochlear duct as well. This can allow, as can be a pathway for sound to move from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani right here. So we have three different chambers, the scala vestibuli, scala tympani, and in between them we've got the cochlear duct. And within the cochlear duct we have the organ responsible for hearing. And the best way to think of this cochlear duct right here and how it operates is that it operates very much like a musical instrument, in particular a piano. So what can you tell me about a piano? How does a piano make sound, and how is a piano organized so that it can be used to make music, for instance? It's got strings that vibrate back and forth because sound is a mechanical wave, right? And what can you tell me about the strings? Are they all the same size? All the same thickness? I don't know if you've looked inside a piano, but usually a piano, maybe I'm going to draw it backwards, but I'm going to make it look like the how your ear functions. So let's say here is the oval window, and then here down here is the round window. So sound enters the oval window. And a piano kind of looks like this, right? And here are the big, long strings, big, thick ones, right? Not so long, not so thick, and then some intermediate length strings. And then down over here, what are the strings like? Really tiny and thin. So if you hit these strings down over here, what kind of sound does it make? A really high-pitched sound. That's as high as my voice goes this morning. Okay? But if you vibrate, if you hit these strings over here, it vibrates how? With a really low frequency. Okay? And then the middle strings have, what, a mid-range type frequency. So the cochlea is arranged just like this. So when sound comes in, and if it's a low note, the sound comes all the way close to the helicotrema, and then it goes across the cochlear duct, and when it goes across the cochlear duct, it's going to vibrate that part of the ear, and then that part of the ear is going to send nerve information to the brain. And in our brains, we have pianos, too, that get stimulated, and we get the appreciation for sound. But if it's a high-frequency sound, it enters the inner ear, the cochlea, and what is the duct that it enters? The scala? Vestibuli goes across the cochlear duct, which is really narrow and thin. It vibrates at a high frequency and then goes into, what's the third chamber down over here? That's the scala tympani, right? And then it leaves the round window. And when it goes across the cochlear duct, it vibrates this part of the cochlea and produces a high frequency sound. Okay? And then I guess maybe the other thing that you should know is what part of the brain appreciates sound? Did we talk about that? I'm not sure we mentioned that. That's in the temporal lobe, right? So that those then the organ within the cochlear duct sends signals to the temporal lobe for your appreciation of sound. All right. Okay. So that is the cochlea, the different fluid compartments in there. And let's go back. And this is a cross section of the cochlea. So here are the different chambers within the ear that's been all wound up. All right, so let's just look at one of these structures right here. Here's the oval window, here's the round window. Remember, sound comes in, the scala vestibuli goes across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani down here. So it's actually a little bit difficult to look at this diagram. So let's zoom in to this region. And now you can see the three different chambers within the cochlea. Here's the vestibuli, down over here is the tympani. And in between is the cochlear duct, and they all have fluid. There is perilymph in the scala vestibuli and scala tympani, and there is endolymph within the cochlear duct. But nonetheless, there's still fluid, so sound transfers through fluid pretty easily. And when sound jumps across from the scala vestibuli into the tympani right here, it vibrates all of this material that's in the cochlear duct. Okay, so now how does this send electrical information to the brain? Well, it has to do with this organ right here. So this is the organ for hearing, and we call this the organ of Corti. And let's zoom into this region right now. So we really are zooming into this region. And so here is the scala tympani down over here, and then up over here is the scala vestibuli, way up over here. Okay, and we see a little flap. Right here, this is the tectorial membrane, and this is the part of the organ of Corti that vibrates up and down when sound moves across the cochlear duct. This thing vibrates up and down, but it's attached to some receptor cells. So here are a number of receptor cells that are anchored to the basilar membrane, and the apical part of these cells have these cilia. Sometimes we call these stereocilia, sometimes we call them hairs. They're not hairs like you have on your head. They're very, very small. And when the tectorial membrane vibrates up and down, guess what happens to these hairs or these stereocilia? They bend, they move. And when they bend and move, that sets up electrical information in these cells that send the electrical information to the cochlear nerve, and then that cochlear nerve goes to the auditory cortex, which is in the temporal lobe for you to appreciate that sound. So these cells right here are what we call hair cells, not because they grow hair inside your inner ear like you have on your head, but because they have these receptor stereocilia that can create electrical events inside them, which end up going to the brain. So if this tectorial membrane doesn't vibrate up and down, then these cells really don't do anything. They don't send any signals to the brain at all. Okay. So what I want you to know about hearing is what part of the inner ear is responsible for hearing in terms of the bony labyrinth. What bony labyrinth within the inner ear is responsible for hearing? It's the cochlea, the thing that looks like a snail, right? And if you look inside that snail, you see these different fluid compartments right here. And within the cochlea, what is the organ that's responsible for hearing? It's that organ of Corti. And then within the organ of Corti, what's the receptor cell that actually transduces sound energy into electrical energy that your brain can appreciate? What's the actual cell? Are you kidding me? A hair cell? Okay. Actually, you're right. It is the hair cell. All right, these hair cells right here. I'm just trying to see if you're following lecture. Hopefully you're a little bit more awake than I am this morning. But it sounded like some people were. It's a hair cell. Not that these cells produce hairs, but they have these stereocilia, and when these stereocilia vibrate, that sends electrical information to the primary auditory cortex. And I'm not going to talk about these supporting cells right here, but it is these hair cells. These are the receptor cells for sound. Because, and why would you say that if you just look at the anatomy? Because what are these hair cells connected to? The tectorial membrane that vibrates up and down, just like the mirrors on your car when you get the stereo plane. Okay? All right, so that's for hearing. Now, what about some other senses? Let me see what else I got to say. Okay, balance. Oh, this is kind of interesting. You might want to know that I'm not going to test you. I don't think I have any questions on the test for this, but deafness can be produced by a couple different problems. Yeah, questions. Do I have a question on, is it, it's up over here somewhere? Okay, here's my cursor. Where do I go, up or down? Yeah? Right here. Ah, I see it. Okay, questions? All right, so here's the statement. The basilar membrane proximal to the oval window is narrow, all right, and stiff. Narrow and stiff. That means that if it's narrow and stiff, what's the length of the organ of Corti right there? It is really, really short, and it's really stiff. So it has a tendency to vibrate how? Very rapidly, a high frequency, or very slowly, low frequency. Okay, yeah, just like a piano. The high frequencies on a piano are short strings and they're really, really tight. They vibrate very fast. But on a piano, the low notes are really long and there's not a lot of tension in those strings, so they vibrate very slowly. And that's how you tune a piano up, is by changing the tension on those strings, right? And you got to pick the right size to just get in the ballpark. So the question is, once again, let's see if I sort of answered it. What tones vibrate the proximal part, the part that's closest to the oval window? That's high frequencies, because that's the narrow end of the organ of Corti. Okay, and then the next question, the basilar membrane distal to the oval window, that's out by what part of the cochlea? What's the end called? That's called the helicotrema. That's the wide part. right? So that's the part that vibrates really slowly. So low frequencies, when they get into the ear, stimulate that part of the cochlea near the helicotrema or the distal regions of it. How's that? Yeah, that's it. Okay. Okay, so deafness, we can maybe break down deafness into two kinds of conditions. All right, there's something called conduction deafness. So sound cannot be conducted to the inner ear, maybe due to rupture of the eardrum, or maybe due to otitis media. And media just means the middle ear. Otitis means an inflammation of the ear. So if somebody has a middle ear infection, that's going to plug up their ears, they won't hear very well. That's a kind of conduction deafness. Or otosclerosis. And otosclerosis is when there's degeneration of the auditory ossicles. So you can, since they're bones, you can get arthritis in those bones as well. And they won't vibrate. And if sound can't get through the middle ear, then of course, then you don't have any sound entering the inner ear. The other kind of deafness is called sensory neural, and this is damage to the organ of cordia itself, or even nerves that are going to the brain. Right, so the outer ear and middle ear is operating just fine, but something is inappropriately happening to the inner ear. So those are the two kinds of problems. So somebody might be able to get to overcome conduction deafness with a hearing aid, right? But a hearing aid won't help somebody that has sensory neuro damage, for instance, if there's damage to the organ of cordia, because no matter how loud the sound is, if the organ of cordia is damaged, you won't hear anything. And in that case, then you need something that we call a cochlear implant, something that actually replaces the organ of cordia, and it's just an electrical device then that directly stimulates the cochlear nerve. And some people do pretty well with that kind of implant. Sound doesn't really sound the same, but they might be able to at least understand spoken language if they're familiar with that language. Okay? All right, so those are two different kinds of deafnesses. Okay, so balance is important for the inner ear, and balance only requires the inner ear. It doesn't need the auricle, doesn't need the auditory ossicles. It just needs the inner ear, and we have two kinds. We got static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. All right, static equilibrium is the kind of sense of linear acceleration. So what the heck is acceleration? Linear acceleration is when you're changing velocity. So if you're going 60 miles an hour and then you stop all of a sudden, we call that what? Deceleration. And you feel forces on your body, like if you're driving in your car. Or if you're stopped and all of a sudden you accelerate to 60 miles an hour, you're changing your velocity, you're going from 0 to 60. And again, you experience certain kinds of forces. If you're sitting in your car and stomp on the accelerator, right, and you accelerate to 60 miles an hour, where do you feel that force? Like on your back, right, because you're being thrown backwards, right? And then if you're going 60 and you step on the brakes, which way do you move? You move forward. Okay. All right, so that is just linear acceleration. And gravity is accelerating us. I can't really describe very well why gravity acts like linear acceleration. You have to take, for instance, a physics class or something. But for instance, since I'm standing right now, which way is gravity pulling me? It's pulling me down. But where do I feel that force? I feel the force on the soles of my feet, right? So that's like gravity is actually like accelerating me up because I feel that force on the bottom of my feet, right? So that's kind of strange to think about it that way. But gravity acts like a linear acceleration. It's pulling on stuff. And you have organs within the vestibule, and we call these the maculae, that can sense that linear acceleration. And even though you're not moving, if you bend your head, if you tilt your head down, then gravity is pulling on your head at a different angle, and you have a sense at what position your head is in because gravity is pulling on the organs within the maculae right here. The second part of the balance system inside your inner ear is for kinetic equilibrium. And kinetic equilibrium comes about through the semicircular canals. You could probably remember what those look like. Those are the semicircular bony labyrinths in the inner ear. This is for what we call angular acceleration, when you start to spin, right, or twist or some kind of motion, but not linear motion. So what kinds of tricks maybe did you do to yourself when you were just a little kid to experience an alternate reality? You could spin, right? And then all of a sudden you could stop. And what happened to the world even though you stopped spinning? What was happening to the world? The world was spinning. Okay, so through the sense of kinetic equilibrium right here, and that's due to the semicircular canal. So I'll explain how these two different senses develop. Okay? All right, so the parts. The bony labyrinth would be the vestibule for static equilibrium or linear acceleration. The semicircular canals are the bony labyrinth for what we call angular acceleration. Yeah. Bony just means bone, some kind of osseous tissue. And labyrinth just means it has a bunch of rooms and chambers and passageways and things like that inside of it. So it's a descriptive word, but, you know, I could show you. Oops, let me flip back a couple slides. Okay. So the bony labyrinth, for instance, in lab, when you have that ear model, do you remember seeing these structures right here in that ear model? Let me go back one more. Remember looking at these structures right here? They were kind of hard, and they were kind of whitish colored, and that's because they're really actually made out of bone. So this is the bony labyrinth within the petrous region of the temporal bone. So this is like a little exoskeleton that protects all the organs that are inside the inner ear. So we call that the bony labyrinth. All right, and they are all connected together. The three parts of the bony labyrinth are the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. And in some of the models in lab, part of the bony labyrinth of a semicircular canal has been cut off, and they have some little plastic tubes that you can see making this turn right here that are filled with the fluid, and that just represents the endolymph within the bony labyrinth. Okay, so there is fluid deep inside the bony labyrinth of all these different parts. So that's bony labyrinth. Did I sort of explain that to you? Okay. All right, so I want to go here. All right, so gravity always produces linear acceleration on your body, right, when you are not moving. Even if you're sitting up, you know what position your head is in. If you're lying down and your head becomes horizontal, gravity is pulling on your vestibule in a different angle, and the vestibule can determine that. We have two organs within the vestibule that give us the sense of linear acceleration, and these organs are called the utricle and saccule. And these both are called maculae. So the utricle is a maculae, and the saccule is a maculae. But you have two of them, so they got two different names. So both the utricle and saccule contain the sense organs that call maculae for linear acceleration. And what's interesting about these organs right here is that they have little crystals associated with them, calcium carbonate crystals. So you have little like rock gardens inside the vestibules of your inner ear, and they're heavy. So guess what gravity does to those crystals? It pulls on them because they're heavy, all right? And the crystals are sitting on top of a gelatinous mass, all right? And that gelatinous mass deforms when gravity pulls on these little crystals that are inside your ear. So let me show you a picture of how that looks. All right, so we're looking at the utricle and saccule right here within the vestibule. That's this center part of this bony labyrinth. All right, and let's zoom in to one of them. Okay, so here you can see a bunch of calcium carbonate crystals right here. And on Oh, I tell you what. No, here are the crystals up over here. Can you see that? Not very well. Let me turn the lights down. Let me try that one. Let me try that one. Did they show up any better? A little bit. Now I can't find my cursor. Ah. Oh, here it is. All right, so here is a maculae right here. All right, and here you can see some of those otoliths or calcium carbonate crystals. And they're sitting on top of this membrane right here. This is a little gelatinous mass. It's like jello. But poking up into this jello right here are some stereocilia, or you could call these hairs. And what kind of cell produces these stereocilia? It is it's a hair cell. All right, and so when your head is upright, these otoliths are pressing down on the gelatinous mass, and they really don't bend the stereocilia. But as soon as you turn your head, guess what happens? So if you look down, these otoliths then are being pulled by gravity that deforms this gelatinous mass, and since these stereocilia are embedded in that gelatinous mass, they pull on the stereocilia, and that institutes electrical activity in these receptor cells, or receptor hair cells, and then that information goes to the brain via the vestibular nerve. All right? And then when you put your head back upright like that again, the stereocilia aren't bent, and then electrical information is not sent to the brain. All right? And so that gives you the sense of head position. Or if you're in a car and you start to accelerate in a forward direction, guess what happens? These otoliths like to stay where they are, and they end up back over here and then deform these stereocilia, and you get the sense that you're being accelerated in a forward direction. Okay? And then when you stop, what happens? This is basically what happens, right? The otoliths keep going forward, and the stereocilia bend the other way, and you have the sense of de-accelerating. Okay. So, for linear acceleration, you should know what the bony labyrinth is. What's the name of the bony labyrinth for linear acceleration? It's the bony labyrinth is the vestibule. All right, and then what is the organ for detection? What organ detects linear acceleration? It's the maculae, and there's two different ones. You got the utricle and the saccule. That's the organ. And then what's the receptor cell? Now you're really kidding me. Is it a hair cell? Yeah, it's a hair cell. Almost exactly the same kind of cell that's used for hearing. Right? And it's just due to some kind of mechanical deformation of those stereocilia. Okay, so this is for what we call static equilibrium or linear acceleration. All right, we only got one more thing, and that's for kinetic equilibrium. All right, so what's the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium? It's the semicircular canals, and this is for twisting, right, or rotational acceleration, or rotational acceleration. Okay, or angular, that means spinning. All right, so the organ inside the semicircular canals that generate signals, sends them to the brain for angular acceleration, is the crista ampullaris. All right, so let me find the crista ampullaris right here. Okay, oops, crista ampullaris is going the wrong way. Crista ampullaris is right here. All right, so you see the cochlea, all right? And what's the organ in there for hearing? Organ of Corti. What's the receptor cell? Hair cell. Here's the vestibule with the utricle and saccule. And what's the bony labyrinth right here? That's the vestibule. Okay, and then here are the semicircular canals. And at the base of the semicircular canal, there's a little bulge, and that's what we call the ampulla of a semicircular canal. How many semicircular canals do you see right there? There are three. Because how many dimensions does space have? There's three dimensions, right? You can go forwards and backwards. You can go right and left. And what's the third one? You can go up and down. So So you can spin in any one of those directions, right? And your ear will tell you that. Or maybe at some combination of those directions, and you would know what angle you're spinning at. Okay, so here is the organ that's inside the ampule of a semicircular canal. We call that the crista ampullaris. So here is the ampule. And don't forget, there's endolymph within the semicircular canals. And there's only fluid in the semicircular canals. There's no structures. So that fluid can flow. It can flow in what? Kind of a circular kind of motion. Right? And where the structure is, where the organ for angular acceleration is in the ampulla. And this is it right here. We call this the crista ampullaris. So that should be pretty easy to remember. And there is another gelatinous mass, just like what we saw in the maculae. And this is very similar to the tectorial membrane that we saw within the organ of Corti. So this thing can move. It can deform. And what it does, it changes the shape of these stereocilia that are poking up into it. And what kind of cell produces these stereocilia? It's going to be some more hair cells right here. Right, and so when the cupula, that gelatinous mass, deforms, that sends electrical information to the brain that you're spinning. So how on earth does that work? So don't forget about this fluid right here. Okay, so let me see if I can do a little demonstration for you. I might be able to, if I can figure out how this works. Okay, so I need some fluid. Where is some fluid? I think I brought some with me. Right here, I got some fluid. So what do we call this fluid right here? Yeah, I know it's water, but in terms of the ear, what do we call that? This is endolymph. Okay, so here is some endolymph. And what part of the ear are we talking about right now for angular acceleration, right? So this is endolymph within a semicircular canal. And all mass has a property of inertia. What does inertia mean? Yeah, it's a resistance to, if something is stationary, anything that has mass likes to remain stationary. Unless you apply a lot of force to it, then it will start to move, right? So mass has a tendency to stay still. It doesn't like to move. That's one concept of inertia. The other point for inertia is once you get matter in motion, once you accelerate it and get it in motion, guess what it likes to do? It likes to stay in motion. It doesn't like to stop unless something is going to oppose it. Okay. So, for instance, maybe over spring break. What was happening over spring break? Anybody have a party? A lot of family come over? Anything? Not really. Pretty nice, quiet time. But let's see. What's coming up? Maybe 4th of July is coming up. Right? And you're going to have a picnic. And you're out on a picnic table, and you put all a bunch of stuff on the picnic table, soda pop and salad, right, and a whole bunch of stuff. And you have, what do you call that thing that you put on top of a table? Tablecloth, right? Okay. And so you want to show everybody that you know something about inertia. What can you do with that tablecloth? You can pull it out, right, without disturbing anything on the picnic table. And you should probably try this at your next party, but I'll demonstrate how it's done here so you don't mess up. Okay, so we said inertia is what? Inertia means mass, when it's stationary, doesn't like to move. Right, so I'm going to try to move this piece of paper without affecting this bottle right here. This is like the endolymph within the semicircular canals. Is that really easy to do if I start to pull it a little bit? See that it's moving? But what if I move it like that? Okay, I've accelerated this paper very fast. Yes, thank you so much. Okay, so you can do that on a picnic table, no problem, or maybe during Thanksgiving or something. Okay, and it impressed a lot of people, the wine glasses with wine in it and all that kind of stuff. So that just demonstrated inertia. All right, so how does that relate to this diagram right here? Well, this right here, the paper that I moved, is representing your head when you start to spin, right? So this is your head, and when you spin, what does your head do? It starts to spin. But the endolymph, the fluid inside the semicircular canals, really isn't connected, isn't glued to the semicircular canal. It can flow. So when the semicircular canal starts to move, what does the endolymph do? It likes to stay stationary because it has inertia. But if the semicircular canals are moving, but the fluid is standing still, what's it going to do? Right? So when the, where's my cursor? When the semicircular canal starts to move, the crista ampullaris is fixed to the semicircular canal, so it's going to move when you move your head. But what about the endolymph? It's going to want to stay stationary, right? So when you start to move, twist your head, this endolymph is going to stay stationary and it's going to flow over the cupula. And when it does, it's going to bend the cupula and it's going to bend the stereocilia. All right, so as soon as you start to twist or turn, that endolymph flows over the cupula and then you have signals being sent to the brain saying that you're starting to rotate or twist or turn. And let me see if I have a picture of that. Yeah, kind of. So here is with somebody standing stationary, and when they first start to turn, right, so their head is turning in this direction, so that means that this crista ampullaris is turning in this direction, but what about the endolymph? It wants to stay still stationary, so it's going to push on the cupula in the opposite direction and deform these hair cells, and that sends action potentials to the brain so that you have a sense of twisting, twisting motion. Now, what happens if you twirl around for a long period of time? Okay, so what happens to the endolymph, right, if you start doing that for a long period of time? The endolymph catches up with, right, it catches up with your semicircular canals, so it starts to turn with you, right, so now the endolymph is turning at the same speed as the crista ampullaris, but you don't want to spend your whole life twisting and turning around. What do you got to do? You got to stop, right, so all of a sudden you stop. What happens to the endolymph that's now caught up to your spinning motion? Because it has inertia, it wants to keep spinning. All right, so can I describe that to you? Sure, I can show you that. So here is what? Endolymph. Here's the crista ampullaris. And after a long time, they all catch up with each other, but then the crista ampullaris stops, and what happens? The endolymph keeps moving. All right, it wasn't so dramatic. Okay, but you can see the endolymph moving still. Right? And it slowly slows down. So when you stop, guess what happens? The endolymph pushes on the cupula back the opposite way, and that sends the opposite signals, giving your brain the sense that now you're spinning in the opposite direction. So who believes me? Nobody. A couple people. All right, try that at home later. Right? You can start spinning, and then stop and open up your eyes, and guess what the world is doing? It's spinning in the opposite direction because you've confused yourself with that endolymph that is now flowing in the opposite direction because of inertia. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about senses. Right. Except, make sure you have this nice matrix, this descriptive matrix in your mind for the test next week regarding the senses of the inner ear. How many sensors do you have in your inner ear? Yeah, you got three. All right, as a matter of fact, how many parts are there to your ear? How many major parts are there to your ear? Three? What are they? Yeah, I'm going to start with outer. Yeah? Oh, I put that too far away. Middle. And then inner. And what are those three senses again? You got hearing, and then you got static, yeah, static, equilibrium, and what kind of acceleration is that? That's linear acceleration. I'm going to abbreviate that. So hearing, static equilibrium, and the other one is kinetic equilibrium. What kind of acceleration is that? We call that angular acceleration. And I'm going to abbreviate acceleration again. All right, so for the outer ear right here, tell me if you need the outer ear for any of these particular senses. Do you need your outer ear for kinetic equilibrium? You would say no. Okay, what about static equilibrium? Could you tell if you were being accelerated, maybe if something happened to your auricle right here, if it got cut off? Could you still tell? Absolutely. No problem. So you don't need your outer ear for linear acceleration. What about for hearing? Yeah. It helps focus sound energy into your external auditory meatus hitting the tympanic membrane. What about the middle ear? Do you need that for static or kinetic equilibrium? No. You have no kinds of receptor organs or anything there. What about for hearing? Yeah, if there's damage to the middle ear, we call that what? Conduction deafness. Maybe if there's arthritis of the auditory ossicles, for instance, or damage to the tympanic membrane. So middle ear, yes. And inner ear. What about these three senses right here? It would be yes, yes, and yes, right, for all of them. Okay, now what about the bony, what's the name of the bony labyrinth? Okay, let's do hearing first.
Cochlea.
It's the cochlea. Cochlea. What about for static equilibrium or linear acceleration? That is the vestibule. And for kinetic equilibrium? The semicircular canals. And what do all of these structures have inside of them?
Organs.
They have organs, and they also have endolymph. It has fluid, right? It has endolymph and fluid. But organs I like. Let's talk about organs. What kind of organs for these different senses are in, what's the organ in the cochlea?
Organ of
Corti. Organ of Corti. And I capitalize it. Why do I capitalize it right here? Because it's named after somebody that first described it. Signor Corti, or Signorito Corti, I'm not sure who it was. It was a Corti of some kind. Okay, the organs for static equilibrium. The maculae. And you got two of them. What, you got the utricle and saccule. Okay, and for kinetic equilibrium, what's the organ? The crista ampullaris. Where's the crista ampullaris located? And the ampules of the semicircular canals. Okay, and then, all right, this is just a nice little synopsis. What about the receptor cells? What are the receptor cells for hearing? I want to say, what? Are you kidding me? But you're right. What part of the organ of Corti do the hair cells maybe articulate with that vibrate them? What's the membrane called? That's the tectorial membrane. You should know something about that tectorial membrane. What about the receptor cells within the utricle and saccule? What are the receptor cells in the maculae? Somebody should tell me.
Yeah.
Back row. Really good. Hair cells. And what about for angular acceleration? What are the receptor cells for angular acceleration? Hair cells again. All right, so I think you should probably be pretty impressed that your body is using basically that same cell for what? Radically different kinds of senses, just applied in a little bit different way. And you get a much different appreciation of your world depending on how those hair cells are engineered into your inner ear. It's pretty amazing. Okay. All right, so that's it for senses. Any question on senses? All right, so I don't think I have any questions for you on what inertia is, though. But you should probably get a little feel for why your semicircular canals do what they do. Yeah. A ringing sensation in the ear. Yeah, we call that tinnitus. And you can hear other kinds of things too. Sometimes maybe you might hear a little thump, thump, thump. And that's because, I'll talk about tinnitus in just a second, but that thump, thump, thump is because the auditory ossicles do have muscles attached to them. Ah, I think here we see one. We see muscles. All right, like the tensor tympani muscle. All right, and then there's a stapedius muscle right here. These help protect your ears when the sound level gets very, very high. That can damage your inner ear. These muscles contract, and it dampens the vibrations of the auditory ossicle, so it doesn't transmit such the same amount of sound energy to your ear. So sometimes these twitch, just like you might have a twitch in your eyelid or some other part of your body, and you'll hear like a thump, thump, thump maybe all day long, usually related to maybe caffeine or nicotine or something, or probably those two things, caffeine or nicotine. If you're drinking Coke and coffee all day long, that has a tendency to stimulate some muscles into a little twitching like that. Tinnitus, on the other hand, is due to something involving the organ of Corti. And in a lot of times, we don't really know why that is. It might have been due to a viral infection or some kind of infection of the organ of Corti, but it's just a persistent little buzzing or hissing sound that people can't get away from. And it can be really annoying because you just have to hear that thing all day long. Sometimes it's really resistant to treatment, and I'm not sure anybody really knows how to diagnose it very well and how to treat it very well and exactly how it develops.
Is that the same as when you're around loud?
You know, it could be the same thing. So loud music, if you go to a concert, your ears might be ringing later that evening or even in the morning, and that could signal damage to the organ of Corti. And so that's going to produce a sensory neural kind of deafness? Yeah. Tinnitus. So it could be, it's probably caused by maybe hundreds of different kinds of things. I don't think we really know how to treat it very well. Okay. If somebody has otitis media, an infection of the middle ear, you know, that might help, but it's not always associated with tinnitus. And sometimes people just get tinnitus as they get older. So sometimes it's just an age-related effect, too. Yeah. So sometimes there aren't very good answers to a question like that. Tinnitus is one of those things. Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you have questions at the end of the book, probably you might want to make sure you know the questions at the end of the chapter. Yeah, let's see what else. But in terms of lobes of the brain, you should know central nervous system pretty well. You should know the cortex for hearing, which is the temporal lobe. You should know what part of the cortex do you use for vision? Occipital lobe. Okay, and then general sensation from all over your body goes to the parietal lobe, and you should probably know exactly what gyrus that is. What gyrus of the parietal lobe does that go to? The post-central gyrus. And then you should know what lobe of the brain is important for initiating motor activity, voluntary motor activity. And that's the frontal lobe, and that's kind of easy to remember because where do you have the motor in your car? In the front. But what's not so easy to remember is what gyrus is the premotor cortex located in. And it's right on the other side of the central sulcus, so we call that the precentral gyrus. So precentral is for motor, postcentral gyrus is for somatosensory perception. That's sensory perception that you have on the surface of your body. Okay? Okay. So pathways, I didn't really talk much about the pathways. Okay, so guess what we're going to do now? We're going to get into a fun chapter, the heart. Where's the heart at? Because the heart will be on your test. And I probably can't cover the heart in 20 minutes, so we're not going to have a test on Monday. So we'll have the test on Wednesday, but you know what? You still got to, you got to pretend like you have a test on Monday, because there's a lot of chapters on this test, and if you just blow off this weekend, then it won't make much sense for you to even come and take a test on Wednesday. So you got to study a lot over the weekend, right? Including the heart, because if you study the heart over the weekend, then when we have a lecture on it or finish up the lecture on Monday, it will make it really easy, right? So please apply yourself over the weekend on these chapters. Which one is heart? see, what is heart? 17? 18.
Why is jumping 17?
Say what?
Why are you jumping 17?
Maybe I'll go back to it. Okay, because I wanted to kind of keep up with lab just a little bit. You guys are already in lab. All right, so cardiac. Okay, so we're talking about the heart. What's another name for the heart? It's called the myocardium. All right, myocardium, myo standing for muscle, the heart muscle. So let's just talk about the size, the shape, location, and some landmarks on the heart. The heart is about as big as your fist. Right, so if you're a small person with a small hand, that's pretty much the size of your heart. If you're a really big person, your heart is about the size of your hand, your fist. Okay, and the heart, I got to erase this table right here. The heart, generally, what kind of shape does the heart have? It kind of, it looks heart-shaped, but think of a three-sided object. It kind of looks like a triangle, right? It kind of looks like a triangle, but it's an upside-down triangle. All right, so a heart kind of looks like that. So this, on a triangle, what do we call a pointed end? That's the apex. So this is the apex down over here, right? And then this is what we call the base of a triangle. That's the base of the heart as well. That's the superior end. Okay. And then location. The location of the heart is pretty interesting so far because we haven't talked much about any kind of asymmetry in the body. We've only been talking about how our body is very symmetrical. So if you have an eyeball on the right side of your face, guess what? You got an eyeball on the left side. Okay, if you got a biceps on your right arm, guess what you got in your left arm? Biceps brachii too. But your heart is not necessarily symmetrical. It's more on one side of your body than the other, and you probably already know what side that is. What side is it more on? It's more on the left side. And the reason why that is because the heart is tilted. The base pretty much is right in the middle of your mediastinum. Remember your mediastinum? It's right on midline. All right, so here's the base of your heart. But as you go from base to apex, your heart has two tilts. As you go from base to apex, it tilts to the left. Right, so that's why you have more on the left side of your body because of that angulation. But the heart is angulated in another way as well. As you go from base to apex, it actually points outside your body. All right, becomes very superficial. So the most superficial part of your heart is really the apex right here because of that biangular tilt on the heart, right? The biaxial tilt. And guess what your heart does? Does it just sit there all day long, or what is it doing? It's pumping blood, and it's actually a fairly violent reaction. It pumps with a lot of vigor, right? So it's not just sitting there. It beats, and when your heart beats, it slams up against your chest wall, just like that. And so the apex bounces off against your thoracic cavity, and in a lot of people, you can even see that point, and we call that the point of maximal impulse. And if you can't see it, you can at least palpate it right underneath your pectoralis muscle. And most people, you can feel that point of maximal impulse, and that's where the apex of your heart is just pounding all day long. And so you can, if you want to find out where somebody's heart is, maybe you're going to do some kind of imaging study or ECG study on somebody, and you want to know about where their heart is, because when people are sick, their heart moves around a little bit. Right, you can always palpate for that point of maximal impulse. All right, but you probably should always ask for permission first before you do that. Okay, that's the PMI, point of maximal impulse. Okay, anatomy of the heart. The heart is surrounded by a membrane system. That's called the pericardium. That's a sac that surrounds the heart. That suspends the myocardium, so there's no bones in the myocardium. There's no ligaments that attach it to a bone. It is just suspended within the pericardium. So it anchors the heart, protects the heart, and prevents even for some overfilling, because we don't want to overstretch the heart. The fibrous pericardium, I don't know if you ran into that in lab at all. The fibrous pericardium is like dura mater. What could you tell me about dura mater? I think you had to maybe mess with dura mater when you did a brain dissection. The dura mater is really tough, right? And you need a really sharp pair of scissors or scalpel to cut through it. The same thing for the fibrous pericardium. It's tough and dense connective tissue. All right, and then we have the serous pericardium. And remember, a serous membrane has got how many parts to it? Okay, it's got two membranes, and then there's a third part, which is the fluid between those two membranes, right? So there is a parietal part that is the membrane that lines the cavity. That's the most superficial part. And then there's a visceral part that touches the surface of that organ, so that's going to be the part that's right on the surface of the heart. And then there's fluid between the parietal pericardium and visceral pericardium that contains pericardial fluid. All right, let me see if I can kind of show where this is. So here we see the mediastinum right here and part of the fibrous pericardium that is surrounding the heart right over here. All right, and then the serous pericardium is going to be, one layer is going to be touching the heart. We call that the visceral pericardium. And the other one is going to be on the surface of the fibrous pericardium, and we would call that the parietal pericardium, and then you have fluid in between them. All right, so here is an illustration of the pericardial membrane. The outermost toughest layer is the fibrous pericardium, and then the inside lining of that is the parietal layer of the serous division. And then you have the pericardial cavity with serous fluid in it, or pericardial fluid. And then here is the layer that's right on the surface of the heart, and we call that the visceral pericardium. All right, because the heart is a visceral organ, so we call that the visceral pericardium. And the visceral pericardium has got another name, because sometimes we don't talk about the pericardial membranes that the heart is suspended in. Sometimes we talk about the heart muscle itself. So we're actually looking at this right here is what the wall of an atrium. We're looking all the way from the superficial part of the wall to the inside part of the wall of a myocardium right here. So the membrane that's right on the surface of the heart, remember we said that the visceral pericardium, but it's got another name. Since it's sitting on top of the heart, guess what we call that? We call it the epicardium. Epi means on top of. So epicardium and visceral pericardium are exactly the same thing. Okay, and people use those terms interchangeably. All right, the next layer of the heart itself is made up of cardiac muscle. So we call this the myocardial layer or myocardium. And just like in bone, remember bone had a periosteum on the outside, just like the heart has the pericardium, right? What did we call the membrane that lines the medullary cavity of a bone? That would call the endosteum. Can you remember endosteum? Well, there is a membrane right here that lines every interior surface, nook and cranny of the heart, and we call that the endocardium, just like the endosteum on a bone. The functions are quite a bit different, though, because the endocardium is very, very smooth, and that allows for blood to flow over the inside surface of the heart. As a matter of fact, all blood vessels have an endothelium lining every blood vessel, which is made up of the same kind of cells that the endocardium is made out of. It makes the surface very, very smooth so blood can flow over it, and it also prevents any kind of jagged edges sticking out into the blood as it's flowing by. Can you imagine maybe what would happen to blood if it was flowing over a rough, jagged surface? Guess what blood likes to do if it's not flowing? Yeah, it likes to clot, right? So if the surface of the inside chambers of the heart wasn't smooth and slippery, it could cause blood clots. And then what could happen? Well, that blood clot is going to be pumped through your circulation, and it could end up in your brain, or it could end up in your lungs, or some other part of your body, killing that part of the body. All right, so that's something really important about the endocardium. It's supposed to be there to prevent blood from clotting within the heart and all these other blood vessels. All right, so those are the membranes around the heart, right? The pericardium. What do we call an infection of the pericardium? Pericarditis. That's pericarditis. And when somebody has pericarditis, there's inflammation and fluid fills up within the pericardial cavity right here, and it actually compresses the heart. And that's really a serious condition, because what happens when your heart gets compressed because this pericardial cavity gets filled up with fluid? What's supposed to enter the heart so that it can get pumped around your body? Blood. Yeah, blood has to get in the heart, but if the pericardial cavity is so big that it's squishing the heart down, guess what can't get in there? Blood can't get in there. So the heart might contract, but if blood can't get in to get pumped out, then the heart can't pump any blood. Right? So that could be a lethal circumstance. And so pericarditis is a very serious kind of situation, and it can be treated pretty quickly because we can put a needle in and aspirate that fluid out, and that will relieve that symptom. But of course, then we have to find out why somebody has pericarditis and alleviate the reasons for it. Okay. All right, so that's the pericardium. Now, what about chambers of the heart? There are, and this you just kind of have to know automatically. How many chambers does the heart have? It's got four. How many valves does the heart have? And again, you're just going to say four, and then we got to kind of piece it together, right? So how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Okay, somebody was fooling around. Okay, say four. Okay, so what about the chambers of the heart? Okay, so here's our triangle right here. And we can break the heart down. I'll leave base and apex right here into four chambers. So there's two superior chambers, two inferior chambers. The superior ones are called, what? Atria. And these down over here are called ventricles. These are ventricles. But what is the other way that we can maybe divide the heart into two regions? Not just superior and inferior, but we could divide it into left and right. And the way I drew the heart right here is as if you were looking at my heart. So this side over here, what hand do I have raised? That's my left hand. Here's my right hand. All right, so this is the left side, and this is the right side. So we can completely characterize all these different chambers by saying this is the right atrium. All right, so I'm just going to put RA. And then what is this over here? This is the LA. And what is this? This is the LV, and this is the RV. Right? Right ventricle, left atrium. Okay. So those are all the chambers of the heart, and these pump blood. Okay. And in order for the heart to stay healthy and pump blood, it should only pump blood in one direction. And blood is going to go from an atrium into a ventricle, and then the ventricle is going to pump it out to some part of your body. All right, and blood should never go backwards. The term we use for backward flow of blood is retrograde. Retrograde means going backwards. So if there's retrograde flow of blood through the heart, that's eventually going to kill the heart. So what do you have to do if there's retrograde flow in the heart? You got to fix it somehow. Maybe you got to go in and repair a valve or replace a valve, or if there's a hole in the heart, fix the hole.
Okay.
Why does it kill the heart? Okay. Well, for instance, is it a lot of work walking up these stairs?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, instead of stairs, think maybe this is a sand dune. Have you ever walked up a sand dune?
Yeah.
Okay. A sand dune is like you take one step up and what happens? You slide back two-thirds of a step. And then you take another step and what happens? You slide back down, right? So if the heart is leaking, letting retrograde blood flow, that's like trying to run up a sand dune. How much work is that? It's more than 10 times the amount of work, right? And can your heart ever take a break? Never. It's got to pump 24 hours a day. And if it's like running up a sand dune 24 hours a day, that's going to kill it. It's just working too hard. That's the best way to describe it with that analogy. All right, so the heart does enough work and it's hard enough to do what it's doing just by running up the stairs and not sliding back down. Okay, so there is something that prevents retrograde flow of blood in the heart. So blood is going to flow from an atrium to a ventricle. All right, and what's going to prevent blood from going from a ventricle back into an atrium? There is a valve, right? So the heart has valves to prevent retrograde flow. So I'm going to draw a couple valves in right here. And these are just little flaps like this. And so we call these atrioventricular valves. And you've got one on the right side, you've got one on the left side. These are, I'll show you some fancy pictures of these in just a little bit. But they also have names because these can be leaky, and we got to be able to diagnose that and then describe how we're going to fix it. This one over here is called the tricuspid because, you know what, it's got three flaps to it. So I'll put another little flap right there. It's got three flaps or cusps. Sometimes we call it a valve leaflet. It's got three of them, so tricuspid. This one over here has only got two. So this is what we call the bicuspid. And tricuspid. All right, the bicuspid has got another name. And that's because when somebody was first looking at the heart, it reminded them of a fancy hat that certain people wear that have these two parts to it. It's got a front part and a back part, and you put it on your head like that. Who wears these fancy? Some of these people have it like really bright red color, like cardinals, okay, in the Catholic Church. That's called a mitre. The Pope wears these kinds of things. That's a mitre. All right, so bicuspid or mitral valve right over here. So how are you going to remember? Tricuspid is on the right side and bicuspid's on the left. Because there's a little saying that says, as you read this, try before you buy. Okay, so that will help you remember what? The atrioventricular valves. Just like that. Okay. Let me draw a vessel in. So here's a vessel that's going to leave a ventricle. Here's one over here. It's going to leave. So blood is being pumped out in this direction. The vessel that receives blood from the left ventricle is called the aorta. Nope, I can't just, it comes off the base of the heart, but it's too crowded up there. Okay, it's coming out of the left ventricle, it shoots up this way. I just can't draw it very well without making a mess of the atria. So I just draw it out of the side a little bit. And the right ventricle is pumping blood out in this direction too. Okay, and so this is aorta. This one here is going to be the pulmonary trunk. Pulmonary trunk. Okay? Well, we got to take a look at this. And trunk is just kind of a fancy name for artery. And before we go, I just want to tell you, there's some valves here because once the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, it shouldn't go back into the ventricle because if it does, it's going to kill the heart. So there's a valve here and here. These are what we call the semilunar valves. So this is the aortic semilunar valve. And this is the pulmonary semilunar valve. And then the last thing that I want to make sure you understand today is that vessels have different names. Some are arteries, some are veins. Okay, and what's the definition of an artery? An artery is a vessel that takes blood where? Away from the heart. So is the aorta a vein or an artery? Artery. Pulmonary trunk, is that a vein or an artery? It's taking blood away from the heart, but it contains drastically different kinds of blood that we're going to look at next time. So guess what a vein is? It's a vessel that brings blood back to the heart. All right, so if you want to look at a diagram over the weekend, that first one that I didn't show you is probably a really good one. Oops, to look at. It has the whole circulation. This one right here. All right, so the heart basically is two pumps back to back. The left one is for what we call the systemic circulation, and the right side pumps blood through the lungs for the pulmonary circulation. So you have two circulations, one systemic and one pulmonary. And hence, you have two sides of the heart to do that. So how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does it have? Good, and then you just got to kind of remember those things. Okay. Let's see if my recorder works. Yeah. Nice.